Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Church for Atheists. I'm Michael.
I am Kumar and I'm feeling horny.
Good God. We don't need you feeling horny.
I mean, this is like a new feeling. It's been a long time since I've had this feeling.
Is this medically induced? Like, what is wrong
Well,
with you?
I will say, I don't know if anyone knows, but this is our special sex edition. So I did pop a blue pill or two for this
Or
episode.
please, if you pop two blue pills and you end up in the emergency room, I'm not coming to get you.
Michael, have you had that happen? Like, is that, are there stories like in the ER that happens like that?
So I am not an emergency room nurse, but yes, that happens, definitely. It's
Hopefully
not a
they
good
don't have
thing.
cold hands.
Exactly. Even though that might be a remedy.
Yes, that could be a remedy. So yeah, this is our special edition, the sex edition, and I'm really thrilled to have a special guest today, Michael. You haven't met, but I've told you a lot about him. My dear friend John Sickler, I've known him since I was in the third grade. And John was a year or two older than me in school. There were two life paths for John, okay? Because we were part of what you called, I know you're gonna hate this, Michael. We were part of what you called the God Squad, okay? We were the Pharisees, okay, in our school, okay?
I could see
And we were the,
that.
yes, we were the Pharisees in our school. And John had something very special about him. He was like the lead Pharisee. He was like the most
No,
holy,
John, you
righteous.
weren't the lead.
Yeah, so there were two things John could end up going to in life. He was gonna either be the next David Koresh, okay, like lead, a group of people on a commune somewhere, okay,
With Kool-Aid.
yes, with Kool-Aid, or John was going to be the most successful porn star in the history of mankind. So,
Those two go together.
well, I mean,
I'm
I
so
think,
excited to hear which way he went.
well, let's find out. Welcome, John.
Welcome. Thank you. I hope that I do not live up to that introduction.
I'm kind of hoping that you do.
Well, here's the deal, and this is really kind of just the evolution of my own story, is that, I became, a theology major, I became a pastor, and a lot of that is credited to the influence that John had on my life. So John's agnostic, he's a social worker, therapist now. I think you can correct me after I introduce you. You live on a goat farm, from what I've seen. You are in a polyamorous relationship, which to me sounds very, very naughty. And then on top of that, you were on a TV show, I think a reality TV show called Sex Life Season 1 on the network Epix. So is this all true, John, or am I just totally making this up about
You're
you?
making
That
it
is
up.
the bulk of that is true. I do live on a farm, a 40-acre farm that's called Three Goats Farm, but we currently have zero goat. So,
That is hilarious. Or is it sad? Were there goats at some point?
We will probably have goats again. We did start off with three goats and then expanded from there. And then we eventually got tired of milking goats. So right now we have pigs and chickens and but mostly we do a lot of produce and fruit orchard and are farming only about a half acre now, and actually looking to expand onto a larger property. Hopefully within the next month or two we'll make an offer and get another 69 acres. So
Wow, that's pretty cool. So I want to go backwards to just where kind of you and I grew up. We grew up in a very conservative religion. There were a lot of rules, a lot of guidelines we were like forced to follow. So I'm kind of curious to know like kind of how you evolved into an agnostic and, from living really bound by so many rules in our childhood. So I'm not where you are, John. Like even for me still, like I'm still like at least feeling like there's some shackles on my ankles, So even if I wanted to do something or think outside of the box, I still feel the guilt of like religion. So kind of share how that kind of progressed for you.
So, my experience of Christianity felt very sincere and very authentic for a lot of years. I think what happened with me was that in my education, I started kind of having incremental shifts. And if something would change, if I would learn something over here and then ponder it and how, well, wait a minute, if this is true or if this isn't true, well, then how would that affect this? And went through a period of, you know, 4 or 5, 6 years of just kind of doing that and moving. I would even say a painful transition toward realizing that my authentic beliefs and worldview just weren't lining up with Christianity anymore. It was just that I couldn't really sincerely say that I believed the major tenets of Christianity. And that was frustrating to me. It was very painful because I saw a lot of other people out there who, you know, I think it's pretty typical that people grow up like we do. And then in their teenage years and early young adulthood, they just rebel and kind of go crazy and, you know, drinking and substances and whatever. And then they meet someone and they get married and then they just sort of swing all the way back to where they were as a child. Oh, I got to raise my kids in the church because that's what I know.
Yeah.
And they never really question things. So, you know, my transition involved a lot of questions and not so much being rejected by my church as much as realizing that the more, well, no, I have to admit that if I was to speak up authentically, I was to have realized I couldn't be a minister anymore for sure. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, my education was social work and theology. So I had that other track and that, you know, has given me a passionate, fulfilling career. So
did you feel a sense of like guilt or concern about others, your family, your community?
Oh, yeah. Very painful, you know, as people started to view me differently, then, you know, I would see disappointment in their eyes and fear sometimes. And you know, I tried to maintain connections with people because I never really went through an angry, rebellious phase. I just kind of tried to say, this is where I am now. And I'm open to feeling different. That's why I say I'm agnostic versus atheistic, because I think one of the most sacrilegious things is certainty. You know, I think one of the major toxic things about our culture nowadays is when you have certainty. There's very few things that I have a whole lot of certainty about, you know, in regards to what I can't see or prove.
Wow, that's deep.
Did you ever wish that you believed still?
Yeah, there's times that I do. I mean, things, you know, I had a ready-made path for me, you know, that I think would have been a good life. So, you know, it is kind of sad. I don't know, the train has left the station, I guess. I'm always open to further shifts that bring me sort of back around or some new understanding of Christianity that lights me up.
So you would probably say that, you know, you're still very much of a spiritual person.
Yeah. I would say so.
Michael, do you feel that way about yourself? I mean, because you kind of always talk about how like 100% hardcore atheist you are, but yes you do. Yes you do. You talk about like eating little babies and throwing people on the altar. So is there a little bit of like, do you feel like the sense of spirituality in your life, Michael? Like, is there an aura of spirituality?
I think there used to be, and I think I shift back and forth between being an atheist-leaning agnostic and an agnostic-leaning atheist. So when I am more of an agnostic-leaning atheist, I think I feel more of a draw to kind of something vaguely spiritual, but I can't say that I'm a spiritual person. I don't know what that really would mean for me. Mm-hmm. But let's go back a little bit. So I want to know more about how you made the jump. Like, when was it that you started kind of thinking more about sexual relationships and the different types of sexual relationships that you were open to?
Yeah. Well, let me answer something really briefly right before that, which is Kumar sort of laughed saying that I was either going to become some sort of, you know, Christian community leader or a porn star. I guess maybe some people perceived me that way. I did have a very, very high sex drive as an adolescent, probably, you know, more so than most, But I also very sincerely believed that intercourse was wrong and that I wanted to save it for marriage. And, you know, there were a number of occasions that was less than 10 or so where I did have sex. But most of the time, I just tried to regulate my really high sex drive without, you know, having intercourse with people. We call it, sometimes we call it veggie sex, of like I was going to have oral sex, but
veggie not, sex.
Yeah. You know, I wanted, so first of all, as background, I had a very high sex drive that I had a lot of difficulty regulating, which then, you know, in more direct answer to your question, about the time that I divorced, I was developing at first sort of intellectual curiosity about polyamory and open relationships. I had a couple of clients who were in polyamorous relationships that were seeing me because they found me to be a good therapist for understanding that, even if I wasn't one myself. And then when I divorced and started experimenting with kind of open relationships as I was dating around, I thought, well, I guess in some ways this does fit. And I was learning things that didn't fit. And then about a year and a half or 2 years after divorcing, I met Gabriella, and that was the first time. I mean, at that point, her and I just fell head over heels in love with each other. And she was very well known, as sort of the queen of polyamory. You know, a number of, I think she was probably involved with 7 or 8, you know, more than that, maybe lovers at the time, and had a primary partner and was involved in a polycule, they call it, of, you know, 5 or 6 people that all, you know, were sexual and close together.
And do all those people know each other?
Yeah, they okay. all knew each other. They all knew what was going on. They would, you know, go on vacations together. And you know, have different configurations of, I guess you could call it group sex together, if you've got more than two. So
hang on, I just gotta fan the flame that's coming near me.
Oh, for crying out loud. You're ridiculous.
I'm just telling my guardian angel, this is a podcast. I am not getting involved.
You're just upset that you didn't have a chance with John back in high school.
This is for educational purposes only today. So
go ahead, John. Ignore him.
So when we fell in love, you know, we're a bit different in personality, and we had very different lifestyles. She grew up as a part of a hippie family, was, you know, getting LSD from when she was, you know, a child, and living all over Europe in a van, and had almost exactly the opposite background that I had, growing up in a cul-de-sac in Dayton, Ohio. You know, my parents have had the same phone number since I was 3 months old, I believe, and they still have that same phone number.
Wow.
Everything, when we fell in love, everything, you know, sort of collided and things started shifting in our life. And she started shedding lovers left and right. And at the same time, you know, her and I started having relationships with other people and experiences with other people too. So I guess to be crude, she was becoming a lot less slutty and I was becoming a lot more slutty.
Okay.
So, you know, at that point it was like, okay, these thoughts and ideas that I had hypothetically in my mind were actually starting to be the way I was living. And, you know, her and I's journey has been navigating that together, how it works with her, how it works for me.
So does she still have, I think I've read that she still has at least one other partner that she's involved with on occasion?
Yeah, her primary at the time she met me, you know, their relationship has become a lot smaller since then. And as my relationship became a lot bigger, we actually had a really interesting thing in our wedding where instead of, you know, the traditional like parents giving you away, her former primary partner essentially gave her away to me and gave us a blessing while we gave him, sort of acknowledged him and his new primary partner. So that was the sort of tearful acknowledgement of how our lives shifted. And I have a great deal of gratitude to him for making space for me. I mean, that was really challenging for all of us. And the fact that that happened without much in the way of drama is really impressive to me.
And do you have another partner on as well?
Do I?
Yeah.
Yeah, both Gabrielle and I like to date people together mostly. That's a lot more enjoyable for us than really going off and having other independent partners.
So one person or a couple that you will date? Sorry, the only thing that I know about this world is anything that I listen from Dan Savage, and that's just
crying out loud.
45 minutes a week.
Uh-huh. Meanwhile, I feel like I'm right here with you, John. I'm understanding what you're saying. Kumar needs a bit of the remedial session.
Okay.
I'm taking notes.
It's both, Kumar. It's either or. It depends. I mean, okay. I would say right now, you know, we've been dating a couple for two and a half years, maybe. We've dated a guy together. Gabriella's a whole lot more bisexual or pansexual. You know, on the Kinsey scale, she's closer to the middle, whereas I'm maybe halfway to the middle. So I tend not to fall in love with men or feel terribly romantic. And you know, there's sexual experiences I've had with men, but they don't feel quite the same as with women. And often we've dated women together, so. She actually is saying now we're probably in the next couple of days going to put together a profile on OkCupid, because she said, you know, I've got a husband and that's absolutely awesome, and I'd still like a wife.
So I remember, this is probably a good 20 years ago, I was visiting you. I think we were in Walla Walla, Washington. You had an apartment there, and you jokingly said something to me, and I'm sure you don't remember saying this to me, but you know, because you're John, everything you say, it's like the Bible. I just retain it, you know. It's like scripture. So one of the things that you said was, as a joke, you said, you know, one of my biggest regrets in life is not having sex with all the people I had the opportunity to have sex with, because your religion prevented you from doing it. Do you remember me saying that, or having that kind of feeling?
I don't remember saying that, and you know, there's one way that I can hear that and majorly cringe, because you know, it sounds selfish and hedonistic, you know, in some way which I would never want to be. But there's a way in which I can hear that now and think, well, you know, any legitimate, like, authentic sexual connection that I could have had with someone without guilt, where I had a good experience and they had a good experience.
Yeah.
Certainly, I wish that had been the case.
Yeah, and I never took it as a hedonistic, like, you know, you're just wanting to just screw every girl around. What I saw, but I think it was in the context of, man, you know, we lived under such a heavy blanket of sexual repression.
Yeah,
we didn't get to really fully figure out who we were or even have authentic connections with people. So really, that's my question for you is, you know, the older I get and the more I read, the more frustrated I get about, like, sex shaming in Christianity in particular, you know.
Yeah, so we sometimes use the term sex negativity to refer to that. It's bizarre the way society treats sex when you think about it. Anthropologically, I mean, there's just nothing else that we treat like this. You know, it's I didn't get these messages from my family. I think my family were pretty supportive and a bit more enlightened about trying to help me along this path. But certainly, there is a culture of teaching that sex is like a dirty and terrible thing, and you should save it for someone you love.
Right, which is perfect.
Which isn't the best messaging. Yeah. So, and that software that is fairly embedded in my nervous system, you know, still now, where I find myself, you know, ambivalent in situations where my brain and my legitimate beliefs and morality and my wife is entirely, you know, supportive of some kind of sexual experience that some part of me sort of shuts down and constricts and go, no, that's wrong.
So explain to me what you think of, or explain to me how you teach sex positivity, because I think that there's definitely, you know, at least in Christian circles, you know, even me, like there's a little bit of me still where I'm kind of like, you can't talk about that. Like, that is just not right. You know, you're just trying to make everybody have orgies and just, you know, go crazy, you know? So I know you, and I know that's not what your intention is. So what does the sex positivity mean for you?
Yeah. Well, what I hope the way I hope it comes across is that a sex positive attitude is not specifically restricted to one type of, for instance, say relationship style. Okay. Sex positivity says that any consensual and authentic way that people want to relate to other people, where there aren't victims, is good and is positive, and that sex is in general a really positive thing. Why should we treat it differently than we treat money, for instance? If I say I'm very generous with my sexuality, what comes to mind if I was to say that?
You're sleeping with lots of people.
Or someone else might, as if, you know, go to like slutty or some derogatory,
yes, apply a name, you know,
kind of term like that, right? But if I have a lot, if I have money and I give it away, that's, you know, to people who you know benefit from it, that's just going to be considered a good thing. So sex positivity says that sex is a positive thing, that we should teach it, that we should make safe places to experiment with it, because it takes experimentation to kind of figure out what's going to be your authentic expression. In my adult age, in the last, especially, you know, since Gabrielle and I have gotten together and the way our lives have combined, I mean, I've just been exposed to so many different things in sexuality that, you know, people just can't talk about. And we had a funny interaction just a couple of weeks ago where we were downstairs and my wife said, you know, we had the hottest, like most romantic sex last night, and my two teenage sons were there and they both went, oh, gross, you know, and sort of winced. And she said, well, how come, you know, what if we said we played the best poker game or watched the best movie, you know, had so much fun, why would that be something that people would be positive about? But sex is just somehow inherently different. You know, sex positivity tries to question those kinds of restrictions.
So in many ways it's normalizing sexuality. So the conservative approach to sexuality that we grew up with, do you find value in that, or do you feel like that kind of just was inhibiting and, you know, that just was destructive to, you know, to who you are today?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I find myself now among the, you know, the sluttiest people that I grew up with. I mean, people would look at my life and go, oh my God, I mean, that's just crazy. But among the community I interact with now, I'm, you know, one of the least slutty people. So
very vanilla.
Yeah, I might appear very vanilla to them. I'm very demisexual, which is a term that means that I have to feel a whole lot of familiarity with a person to even feel aroused. It, you know, it's not enough to have an attractive body in front of me. So in some ways, the way that I've grown up helps me, in that you would think that with the access to sexuality I have right now, that I would really go off the deep end or be a kid in a candy store. You know, I'm in situations, you know, sometimes, you know, once a week or more, where I, you know, am perfectly able to have sex with someone who desires that, or, you know, that have group sex. And I've just say that in this whole last 5 years, I've never, had regrets the next day. Like, oh man, I really shouldn't have done that. Or I'm really sorry, Gabriella. I just, you know, I was so attracted to this person that I neglected you. I mean, my background did make me, Dan Savage uses the word monogamish a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm very authentically monogamish, that I don't get really distracted by novelty in ways that would hurt Gabriella's feelings. So I like that.
Yeah.
I learned, you know, I learned deep relating and that sexuality has a lot of depth to it. I don't just like having recreational sex that is about getting off or having a good time.
So I'm interested to know, how does your sexuality currently interact with your spirituality or your agnosticism? Like, how do those things go together? And what do you find, you know, spiritually inspirational through your sex life?
Yeah, well, there's areas of sacred sexuality, like some people have heard of Tantra. You know, there are areas of sacred sexuality that I've had, you know, a lot of opportunity to explore, where, you know, there are things I've experienced sexually that, you know, just the nature of sexuality gets you to sort of open up and experience things, you know, much larger than yourself, and deep intimate connection with other people that, you know, feels profoundly spiritual to me. And there are ways I think that sexuality can facilitate that, incorporate that. You know, very few people who have had deep sexual experiences would argue, I think, that, oh, those are not spiritual. I think monogamous Christians, you know, would say their sex life includes a lot of spirituality. One way to answer your question is my morality now and my philosophies that guide me, you know, are more closely tied to nature. And, you know, it doesn't take long of working and living on a farm to see that nature, you know, is very sexual from plants to animals to, you know, there's very, very little monogamy in nature. And essentially none in primates. There's only one primate that is monogamous, really monogamous, and they don't live in communities. You know, almost all primates that live in communities experience some sort of, you know, open relationship.
They're monogamous.
Yeah, or not.
Or not at all. Yeah.
Or not at all. You know, my morals are different around sexuality now. I might feel more guilty. Like, for instance, last night I was in a situation of a couple that we're dating that seemed pretty eager to have sex with us. And I was really tired and I did not feel like it. And so my wife and I went to bed early and, you know, we had a great sexual experience and we fell asleep. Now I might actually look at that as with a little bit of guilt and say, oh, you know, those are our, you know, friends that we care so much about. And I feel bad that I let them down, you know, might to a Christian, you know,
like, yeah, look at Kumar's face. He looks like his mind is blown.
Let's talk about sex drive real quick, because, you know, you said you had a really high sex drive as a teenager or young adult. For someone who works very hard to keep a sex drive going at my age, do you still have that same strong sexuality?
I do not. It has changed a whole lot. My wife's, it's very high in my relationship with my wife. We have sex, you know, almost every day or more often, you know, after even 5 years of being together, and it's outstanding. But I think part of when I told you, you know, that I feel regret about sexual experiences I didn't have when I was younger is I just, so much of my bandwidth went to regulating that, you know, like it's hard to just study for a test. You know, I masturbated, you know, once, twice a day on average, I think, for all those years. And now I hardly masturbate at all. So I really like where my physiology is at now, in that I feel really good about my sex life, where there's an opportunity that fits with my morals and values and psychology, but I don't lose a lot of concentration when I should be working, you know, being distracted by it. So that feels great.
So just growing up in your house as a kid and eating your mom's really amazing brownies. Do you remember those brownies? They were like caramel and little, there was a name for it. She had a name for it.
I think, was it just squares?
They were squares and they had little chocolate chips in it. There was a name for it. But
I mean, I love how you were like, I mean, really salivating.
Well, I'm just 30 think, years. No, I'm just thinking like, later. You know, growing up in John's home and he had a big dog and there's his mom making the brownies and here he's talking on this podcast about masturbation. And all I'm thinking is, what the heck does John's parents think about this boy that grew up in that house?
Yeah. Is that the question that I'm supposed to answer now?
Yes.
Well, to my parents' enormous credit, I think my mom especially was terrified that sexuality was going to get me in a world of trouble. When Gabrielle and I first started dating, I mean, she was well known enough that all a person had to, if I said I'm dating someone named Gabriella, they could just Google that name and see interviews and things pop up with her. So that was really challenging and difficult for them. And I think they were thinking that this might sort of blow over as a kind of midlife crisis. You know, after my divorce, maybe I just need to sow my wild oats for a while. So they just sort of didn't want to hear about it for a while and I didn't talk to them about it. And then eventually when it became more serious and she started, you know, she moved in and was getting to know my kids. And then at that point they said, well, let's get to know her and meet her. And they love her as a person now. And to their credit, they've done, you know, they know that I do things in regards to sexuality that makes them, you know, very uncomfortable, but I've never felt harshness or meanness or judgmentalism from them. They're very good at expressing their concerns and telling me they love me and being, you know, very well connected to her. She's, you know, they really like her as a person a lot. Sometimes I feel like when they visit that I don't get to talk to them very much because they're all excited to see her.
Well, it's not hard to love her. I've met her once over coffee and she's just an enormous ball of energy. And I mean, just is the most welcoming and loving human being, you know, so I can see your parents being embraced by that too. When I asked you, you know, do you still have a high sex drive? And you're like, no, I mean, I still have sex once a day. I'm like, what? What?
Yeah,
you know,
I get that. But it's true that I mean the some of that is that you know that then meets. I mean, it's hard to feel sexually frustrated when you're getting regular the kind of sex you want with who you want as often as you want. You know, that's great. And Gabriella has a higher sex drive than I do in general. So, but also having an open relationship can stoke, you know, your own desire for, you know, we call it reclaiming sex, you know, where she's off for 2 or 3 days with Neil and then comes back. And, you know, the kind of sex we have is a bit more, we're both bringing a bit more to the table because there's some, you know, anxiety and some fear and we want to, you know, reconnect in a powerful way. And, you know, so quite honestly, openness can, you know, improve your sex life with your partner because you don't fall into as much, you know, monotony and, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Couple questions, John, I want to ask you. One is, you know, as a pastor, I would do a lot of premarital counseling. And, you know, one of the things that always came up in like session 5 was the sex talk with a couple. So what do you say to a couple who is, you know, very vanilla, but wanting to try new things, but they don't even know how to say it to each other or even broach the topic?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, I encourage, and, you know, I would say a third to half of my practice in my private practice are clients who seek me out for help in their open relationships or polyamory or kink or that sort of thing. So, you know, sexuality is one of the things I talk with clients about the most and they're talking about. For one thing, I want to make it okay for people to, I want to get people over their anxiety to talk about sex. Research shows that just talking about sex in general tends to increase into a feeling of intimacy between you and another person, which has nothing to do with flirtation or arousal. It just increases trust. But that's hard for a lot of people, you know, especially people who've grown up with religious messaging that they might have sort of swallowed whole and are having a hard time digesting into their lives. So getting people to talk about things, for one thing, and in general, getting people to talk about things they want, be willing to say what they want, and to recognize that just because they want something doesn't mean the other person's obligated to give it to them.
That's good. I'm going to ask you rapid fire questions. You ready for it? Four questions. Number one, do you still listen to Christian music?
Sometimes, yeah.
What do you listen to?
Well, I will sometimes, just recently we gave up a house that we were renting that a Sex Positive Portland was doing events in for like 8 years. And the last day I was there, it was empty. I did have to put on Amy Grant, Listen to Walls, If These Walls Could Speak.
I love that song. So, I love that
classic
album.
Yeah, songs ever written, yeah. So, okay. Yeah, I'll get in moods where I pull up old songs. You know, there's certain musicians that can still really move me. You know, Rich Mullins was a favorite of mine.
Yeah, I remember Rich Mullins, and you loved Stephen Curtis Chapman back in the day.
I performed with Stephen Curtis Chapman in concert, actually. Yeah.
Really? That is awesome. Yeah. Okay. Next question. Do you still pray?
Yeah. I don't have a regular prayer practice of speaking words, you know, that we would recognize like Christian prayer. Gabrielle and I do sometimes together, and we're creating these sort of blessing traditions before meals. You know, here at the farm, we eat most of our dinners together. You know, about 15, 20 people eating dinner together. And when I'm, I would say at the really highs and the real lows, you know, there's some sense of reaching out toward, you know, whatever feels like God to me.
You grew up a Seventh-day Adventist. Do you still observe the Sabbath?
No, I don't. I do experience sometimes a bit of a shift. I haven't kept the Sabbath since I was, I don't know, 25 or 26. And for a few years that felt really difficult and challenging. And I still notice a shift on Friday nights where I like to be a bit more reverent or introverted, have a different sort of spiritual feeling than I might on Saturday night.
Okay.
Saturday night, still, you know, Adventist Saturday night's about fun and parties, and Friday nights, it's sort of like Friday night is Lent and Saturday night is Mardi Gras, I guess.
It's built into like your circadian rhythm.
Yeah. A little bit.
For somebody who was a pastor and who also just planned a tremendous amount of programming, do you miss church?
Sometimes, but it's hard to miss church when I live in an intentional community, because that not only meets a lot of those needs, in some ways for me that supersedes the needs. I mean, because our community lives like the early Christian church to a large extent. I mean, we share everything and work together and are there for each other. And talk about deep things and have parties together. And so in some ways I miss worship services sometimes. And I used to love, you know, I considered myself a worship artist of creating, you know, worship experiences for other people. And I don't have as much of an outlet for that. That feels kind of hard sometimes.
Final question. What would you tell 15-year-old John, if you could go back in time?
What I would tell my 15-year-old self at age 47, I guess to some extent, well, first it would have to be in one of those really cool sounding quatrains like Nostradamus or something. Because, you know, I feel like if I talk like that, that'll make it a really good impression.
Yeah.
But assuming I could pull that off, I think my message would be something along the lines of, you know, the message that older queer people tell young people, which is that it gets better. Mm. I probably wouldn't believe at 15 that I would love dancing in my 40s and that I wouldn't actually feel stiff, and that Avenus joke about if you, what's the joke? Why don't Seventh-day Adventists have sex standing up?
Yeah.
Because it could lead to dancing.
Right.
That I would feel free and happy and active in my body. That I would experience things sexually in my late 40s that I never even knew to look forward to or to want. And that the best of those experiences would be either include my wife or be with my wife. Mm. And that no matter how good a sexual experience I could have, you know, it's sort of like having an amazing meal. You're still going to get hungry again. So, you know, don't get off the path of keeping what's most important in your life, because when you keep sex connected to intimacy and you keep intimacy connected to sex, all sorts of amazing things will be possible for you.
Bro, that's deep, man.
John, thanks for being so honest and being willing to just come on here and share what you're doing, who you are, and what you stand for. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, guys.
York City.